Like I say, we're reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 today, and we are going to be talking about sex. We're just putting that out there. That's what the passage is about, and we believe we ought to preach on all that scripture addresses. So this is what the Apostle Paul wrote to a church that had confusing ideas about what sex is and when it should be appropriately enjoyed and when it should not. And last week he dealt with a passage to say that sex outside of marriage is inappropriate, but this week he's going to address the topic within marriage. So the Apostle Paul writes the following words. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. Interesting that we find things like that written in the word of the Lord. As I mentioned last week, we were looking at a portion of scripture dealing pointedly with the topic of sex. Particularly, the writer was correcting some of the ways in which sex had become misused within a Christian community. People had been misusing sex outside of marriage, so much so that people within the church had been visiting prostitutes to get their fill. That's how much they misused sex within the Christian community. But this week, we're looking at a different problem. It's a different kind of misuse or misunderstanding of sex that takes place within the Christian community. Quite opposite to a preoccupation with sex, which we had been looking at last week, some thought that sex was to be avoided within the Christian community, that it was to be shunned, that sex was to be was thought to be unhelpful to those who wanted to express a purer form of Christian life. You know what I'm saying? If you wanted to be a true and devoted Christian, you would avoid sex. This is what some people in the Christian community had come to think. Now, few of us, I admit, would bring this kind of distortion to the issue of sex these days. We are, in general, as a culture, we are far more likely to fall into the group dealt with in chapter 6, that we are a people bred with a preoccupation with sex. It's everywhere. The phrase sex sells exists for a reason. We are preoccupied with it as a culture. Nevertheless, there may be some of us who grew up almost never hearing a healthy word spoken about sex. And whether this was from your parents or from your churches, we just grew up in a culture that was silent. They never talked to us about what is a healthy expression of sex. And then inadvertently, when churches and parents remain silent to their children about sex, they inadvertently communicate a prudish attitude towards sex. Prudish. That it's somehow a taboo subject, a dirty subject. That's what we inadvertently communicate when we refuse to talk about the things that Scripture itself talks about. And some people in the Corinthian church had started to believe this way. They had started to believe that sex was taboo, that it was to be thought of prudishly, to be avoided and shunned. They had heard Paul confront immorality outside of the marriage covenant, and they had misunderstood what Paul had said, because Paul had come down very clearly that sex outside of the marriage covenant is immoral and should not be part of the Christian life. But some people misunderstood what Paul had said, and now they thought the whole well was poisoned, that all sexual relations must somehow now be avoided. And that's not what Paul is saying. He's not saying that sex within marriage must be avoided, belittled, or minimized, or that it is indeed some kind of sub-Christian thing. That's a misunderstanding. And some people were drawing this blanket conclusion from what Paul had said. They were saying things like this. This was one of the sayings that was going around in the church. People were saying it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. That's what the Corinthian church had begun to believe. Paul did not believe this about sex. Paul did not believe that it was good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, not within the marriage covenant. Christianity will not promote that view of sexuality within the marriage covenant. Paul was not protesting the goodness of sex within the marriage covenant. So what we want to look at this morning is, how does Paul address the goodness of sex within the marriage covenant? How is it good? How is it healthy? How can we kindle a lively and healthy appreciation for this kind of marital intimacy? Because that's what Paul will address in his letter this morning, and that's what we want to have a look at. What is a healthy, vibrant life or attitude towards sex within marriage actually look like? With this in mind, and knowing that some church folk, at least in Corinth and maybe here this morning, wrongly believed that even sexual enjoyment within marriage was to be avoided, Paul wrote a corrective piece of instruction, an opposing view to what the Corinthians were saying. Paul said this: each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. That's the correct view that Paul is now promoting. It plainly shows that within the marriage covenant, sexual enjoyment is not only permissible, but also good to cultivate, both by the husband and the wife. By both husband and wife. I hope you're not shocked that the Bible speaks so plainly about these things. I'm so thankful that it does help us think healthily about sex. So I hope you're not shocked that we're dealing with this morning. Sex, after all, is God's gift to the married. And so it might be good for us to expect that his word will also speak plainly to where his good gift finds its intended expression namely within the marriage covenant. What I want to do this morning is just have a look at some of the phrases that Paul has been using when he talks healthily about sex within the marriage covenant. The first one of these is just three I want to have a look at. Speaking of married men and women, Paul wrote the following: each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. And these words remind us that sex is a good and mutual gift to be pursued by both husband and wife, wife and husband. It is a mutual gift that way. You know, these words, in the first glance, challenge our cultural conditioned understanding of sex. Our culture teaches us that sex is par for the course for anyone in any kind of committed relationship. You don't have to be married, you just have to be committed. Our culture goes even further and tells us that sex is not even for the committed. It's for one-night hookups. That's our culturally conditioned understanding of sex. It's what our culture teaches us to believe about sex. But the Bible preserves our dignity as human beings when it talks about sex this way, by preserving it for the marriage covenant. It does so to preserve our dignity as human beings, to guard us from misusing others and from being misused by others with flippant sex. It guards and preserves us from overexposure to those who do not truly love us and are not truly committed to us and will not stick with us through thick and thin in the marriage covenant. It preserves us, it guards us for a fuller dignity, for a fuller beauty and a wisdom that sees sex between husband and wife is there for your good, to preserve you. And it tells us then that all other contexts for engaging in sexual activity is to misuse God's good gift. It is to misuse God's good gift, and the Bible calls this immoral. The misusing of God's good gift, it is immoral. So when we heed the wisdom of Scripture, when we pay attention to verses like this, it protects and guards us from sexual misuse. The second phrase that really interested me with Paul, it's this one. He says the husband should give, and likewise the wife. The husband should give, and likewise the wife should also be giving. Just notice that word give. It reminds us that sex is not primarily a consumer activity. Do you understand what I'm saying here? That it is not just for you to consume the other person. Sex is not all me, me, me. Only have sex when I want. Only satisfy me. Maximize my pleasure. It's not consumer like that. In Christianity, we find that the motivation for sex is actually redeemed in the gospel. What a profound thing that the gospel would even redeem our motivations for sex. In Christianity, we find that God serves our needs of forgiveness through Christ. And so an application of that in the Christian life would be to pursue the interests of your spouse, to pursue the interests of another person, not yourself. That is to say that Christianity recovers the right motive towards sex, that it is giving and serving the other, not taking and consuming the other. It is giving and serving, not taking and consuming. That is how sex is motivated within the Christian life. How wonderfully applicable that is. That husband and wife can sit down together and just ask, am I a consumer? Do I consume you? Or do I serve you well when it comes to sex? Am I serving you well enough? What a wonderful piece of application for us. Here's one more verse that I'd really like us to take a look at. It says this, do not deprive one another. You know, this is very direct in the face of the Corinthian problem, where some people, some married folk, were trying to avoid sex as some kind of more spiritual version of the Christian life. And Paul just says to them, don't deprive one another. It's sort of the torpedo to their line of thought. Don't deprive one another. But I want to say here, be careful with this verse. Be careful with this verse. What amounts to lack of sex within the marriage covenant is somewhat subjective, right? People feel like they lack sex at different levels, shall I say. It is subjective. Wives and husbands have different appetites for sex. What one person think of as enough or sufficient may be more or less than what their spouse thinks is enough or sufficient. So we don't want to be using this verse to set rules about frequency. Do you understand what I'm saying? It is subjective. Be attentive to your spouse. But this verse nonetheless should make us attentive to our spouse. Make us attentive to what is their appetite. Those with larger appetites might like to consider, am I being too demanding on my spouse? And those with a smaller appetite may like to consider, is my weak appetite depriving my spouse? So that both are able to obey this command, do not deprive one another. Figuring it out together, my large appetite, is it too much? Do I need to restrain myself for the sake of my spouse? And the spouse with a weak appetite saying, should I enlarge my appetite? Should I pray to the Lord to give me a greater appetite so that I may raise to the level of my spouse so that there may be a mutual love for one another here, a serving of one another. Both need to be equally considerate so that ordinarily, as long as health permits, that no marriage partner may rightly feel as though they are in a marriage of sexual drought. As long as health permits. In fact, the Bible is at pains to affirm this persistent goodness of sex within the marriage. That it would go on to say for us that the only reason that there may be a legitimate pause in sexual intimacy is for a season of prayer. The only legitimate reason to stop sex within marriage, apart from health, the only spiritual reason you may stop is to pray. And then notice the qualifiers that Paul has given us. That it is only by mutual consent. If you both agree that you should do it, not just one person, but both agreeing. And even if you both agree that we should take pause so that we can pray, it is only for a limited time. It is only for a short season. And then you come back together again to enjoy one another. The Bible is ferocious about promoting the goodness of sex within marriage. What a wonderful, wonderful thing to read. So these verses that we've looked at undermines an unhealthy attitude towards sex, especially within marriage, while at the same time, I hope it has helped kindle and fuel a lively and healthy vision of sexual enjoyment within marriage. These verses promote a considerate and joyful self-giving between the spouses. That said, there is another reason why the Bible promotes, another powerful reason why the powerful promotes and affirms the goodness of sex within marriage. It is because marriage has the power to diffuse powerful drives towards sexual sin. Marriage has the power to diffuse your temptation towards sexual sin. And Paul says it to us twice in the matter of five verses, so we need to pay attention to this. In verse 2, he says, because of the temptation to sexual immorality, have good and healthy sex. And he says it in verse 5, don't deprive one another so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So temptation is always at foot. Even within marriage, there is temptation for sexual sin. There is no question about the power of sexual temptation, which leads to full-blown sinful conduct, including adultery. There is no question that temptation is strong and pervasive, even within marriage. But what makes marriage such a powerful restrainer is the goodness of sexual union between husband and wife, and wife and husband. It is God's means of significantly reducing and significantly weakening sexual temptation. And husband and wife need to pay attention to this. It has been said that the church reformer Martin Luther found that having sex twice a week was enough to keep his temptations under control. Now, I don't know how happy his wife was about that. I don't know how that went down in the marriage covenant between those two. But I don't mention this to set guidelines for sexual intimacy. That's for husband and wife to figure out between themselves. But I mention Luther's example because it points to the reality that marriage has that power to weaken sexual temptation. And it was true in the life of Martin Luther that he found frequent sex with his wife, Katie, or Katerina, as she was known, had that kind of powerful effect on his life to weaken and disable Satan's temptations. So don't overlook this very important aspect of maintaining a healthy and vibrant sexual life within marriage. No spouse, of course, is excused when they fall into sexual immoral behavior within marriage for the lack of sex. You can't tell you can't say to God, well, look, I was immoral because my spouse won't have more sex with me. You're not excused for lack of sex. But equally, it's worth noting that the positive and healthy sex life may well be the means by which God will protect your spouse from sexual temptation. And we need to pay attention to that. Healthy and frequent sex is a means of guarding your spouse against sin. What a wonderful, practical way that you can love your spouse and protect them and offer them shelter from the temptations of Satan. Still, I just want to address one more thing. There may be this nagging idea within Christianity that when all of this is said and done, when we've talked about healthy sex and so on, that there's this nagging idea that the Apostle Paul would rather, you know, all this said and done about marriage and so on, he would rather that everyone be single. Don't get married. Be single. That is the higher level of true Christianity. That is a better version of Christian life. And that thought does nag away at the Christian church. I don't believe this was what Paul promoted. And I want you to just follow this argument with me and just test it out for yourselves. You may disagree, but I just want to make the point that I don't think that Paul viewed singleness as somehow better or more spiritual for the Christian, that it is the better option. I say this because some of us may have heard that marriage is somewhat of a concession, a second tier choice for Christians who can't keep it in their pants, right? That it is a weaker option, all said and done. I don't believe that Paul had this vision of marriage. Paul says for us in the first instance when he talks about marriage, he says, now as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am. And this is a very difficult and technical verse to try and understand. So some people believe that as a concession, he's allowing people to get married, but he would rather that everyone were as he is, and that is single. I don't think this is how we are best to understand this verse. Emphatically, Paul says to us that both singleness and marriage is a gift from God. There are different kinds of gift. One kind for singleness and one kind for marriage, and they are both gifts. If you're single and that is your gift, wonderful. If you're married, wonderful also. They are not competing for a rank about which is the better option in the Christian life. Nonetheless, Paul himself did have a preference for his own gift. As many of us who are married have a preference for our gift. We prefer being married over singleness. But Paul was the other way. He preferred his singleness over marriage. It afforded him freedoms as a missionary that he would not have had if he had been married at that time. The only time, perhaps, when singleness is better, in Paul's view, is if you are able to continue in singleness as a gift from God. As a gift from God. That is, God has granted you a measure of self-control that you willingly remain single. It is your choice. You are free from the burden of this passion burning within you for marriage. That's when it's a gift. If you don't have that, perhaps marriage is your gift and you ought to pray to the Lord for marriage and see what he does with that. The other difficulty with trying to figure out what exactly Paul is saying here is that he says this, to the unmarried and widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single. But that said, it's a difficult verse to understand because it may well be translated as follows. to widowers and widows. I say that it is better to remain single. Because that word unmarried may well mean widower. And many people believe that Paul was indeed a widower. He had lost his wife at some point in time. And if that is the case, and I think there's a good argument to be made, that he's talking at this point to those who were once married but are not now. Because he will deal and talk with about the unmarried later on in chapter 7, and we'll look at that. But for the moment, he's talking about those who were married to have good and healthy sex, and now he's talking to those who were once married but are not now. And this may well have been Paul's own situation. He was once perhaps married, but he is not now. And he's saying, if that's your situation in life, it's better to remain single. But even so, Paul is a realist. Paul is a realist. He's not making a blanket ban on those who are widows and widowers to be married again. He's a realist. So he goes on to say that if you cannot, if that's not what you're cut out for, if singleness post-marriage is not for you, go ahead. The door is open. There is no sin for you there. Be married. Be happily married. He says to us that they should marry if they are not cut out for the single life. So I don't think it is by mere concession that marriage exists, as though it is more Christian to remain single and those who marry choose a second best kind of life. It's not so. Marriage is good. It is a gift, as is singleness, and they are not competing for preference within the Christian community. I'll stop here this morning and I'll just offer a couple of thoughts as we close. Dream a new dream about sex within your marriage. Dream a new dream about sex within your marriage. It is not just to be seen as the husband's privilege and the wife's obligation. Not so in Christianity. Sex in the context of Christianity is much, much better than that. It is the mutual self-giving of one another that seeks to please the other. And with that as your guiding principle, to please, to give and to serve your spouse, there is great liberty and freedom to pursue a healthy and vibrant sexual enjoyment within your marriage. I hasten to add this one more thing. I know I've spoken a lot about the goodness of sex within marriage this morning, but don't think, please don't think, that if you experience sexual disappointment within your marriage, that your marriage is a failure. Please don't draw that conclusion this morning. This passage has given us focus and a time to focus on what is healthy within marriage. But not everyone may experience that. Not everyone may experience sex as it's recovered in the gospel for us. But lack of sex in your marriage is not a deal breaker. It is not a reason to leave or have thoughts about leaving your husband or your wife. There is more to marriage than the momentary pleasures afforded in sex. There is more to a marriage than sex. But what sexual disappointment does afford you? It's an opportunity for open and honest discussion with your spouse, to talk, to consider, to listen, to find ways to help one another regain a gospel-centered way of thinking about sex, especially when it comes to surrendering ground to Satan, who wants to take the goodness of sex and pervert it and crush that within your marriage, and crush and corrupt it into immorality. Jesus came to undo Satan's schemes. We believe that here. Temptation doesn't have to win. Jesus, to him belongs the victory.